This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is no way that you can look back at the history of rock and roll and rock journalism without thinking of Cream magazine. The late Barry Kramer began Cream in 1969, distributed it out of the trunk of his car. But in its heyday, Cream made its home in downtown Birmingham in Oakland County. It was irreverent, profane, often brilliant, and many huge names in music can thank Cream for putting them in the spotlight early in their careers. Cream really has a lasting place in Michigan's musical history. Leslie Pilak is with us. She's director of the Birmingham Historical Museum, and her look at the history of Cream is in the current issue of Michigan History magazine. Good to have you with us, Leslie.
Thanks.
And someone who was right there for a lot of the genius, a lot of the insanity. She was editor at Cream, and these days she writes for the Detroit News, in fact has done so since 1983. Susan Whitehall, so good to have you with us here on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Well, Leslie, some history, if you will. Cream began the same year as Woodstock, the same year Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, the first year of Richard Nixon's presidency, and the first year William Milliken was governor of Michigan. Who was Barry Kramer, and why did he start putting out Cream?
I think you have to realize that the context was also Detroit after the riots, and this was Wayne State University and the culture at Wayne State, and the underground movement was very big at the time. And Barry was part of that scene for some of his early career, and then he began to branch off into publication. He got interested in doing a tabloid, which was named Cream Magazine, and he co-founded it with Tony Ray. And initially, they published it out of Mixed Media, which was his head shop, which was down near the Wayne campus.
I remember it.
Yes. And very shortly thereafter, they began to look at turning it into a regular monthly issue and doing more than just distributing it down on the campus. And that's kind of the start of Cream. And from there, it just became more popular. And Barry eventually made a move to Wild Lake and then to Birmingham. And the Birmingham years were definitely its golden years.
And you were there, Susan, for those golden years.
I was. I had no idea what I was getting into.
What were you getting into? What was that like, those golden years? You started there in 75, right?
I was like just a Michigan State grad trying to get a job, and I had no idea I would luck into this. My parents lived in Birmingham, and I had this little car, little MG Midget that couldn't make it past Birmingham. So this all the stars aligned. I was in the Birmingham, the bookstore that was right below, which was the Little Professor, and I happened to pick up a copy of Cream, which was extremely garish, as always. The cover was like, and here I was, this, you know, hootie-falutie English major, like, oh my God, I've got to get a writing job. Look at this. What? I did love rock. I had been to see the Beatles when I was only 10 years old, but I also had this literary thing on the other side. So I was looking at this thing, and I was looking through it. It was kind of interesting. And then I saw the address, 187 South Woodward. I went up to buy it, and it's Birmingham. I went up to buy it, and the guy, Gene, who owned Little Professor, he goes, oh, those jerks. They owe me money. You know they're right upstairs. I'm like, what?
Wow. And so, up you went.
No, I didn't go quite that quickly, but I did write a letter to the editor then, who was Wayne Robbins. I didn't know at the time I should have really written to Lester Bangs or Jan Uhelski, but I wrote to Wayne because he was on the staff box as the editor. He invited me out to lunch and all that, and he kind of told me I had to hang out with the staff for a while, you know, get to know them before they'd give me writing assignments. So I thought, oh, that must be the way it is. And then Jan took me aside one day and said, he's not giving you any assignments. I will give you assignments. He just wants to hang out with you. So it was girl power from the beginning. And she and Lester really encouraged me, and they would give me writing stuff.
Do you remember your first?
Lester was a great feminist, too, really.
Lester Bangs was?
Yeah.
And we're going to be talking about Lester Bangs. Do you remember your first interview?
Oh, my first interview was Peter Frampton. They were playing Ypsilanti. It was this big, big rock show. It was in a field somewhere. I'm thinking somewhere at Eastern Michigan University, and Ace was playing. They had the big hit, How Long Has This Been Going On? And I got Frampton. But I did stories before that, before I did an interview. I actually translated my first assignment ever. I translated a story on heavy metal from French to English. Metal Erlon.
No, my word.
You know, it's interesting when you think of the cover of Cream and Cream and then America's only rock and roll magazine. But Jan Wenner had started Rolling Stone magazine 2 years before Barry Kramer started Cream in Detroit. Did Cream not think of Rolling Stone as a rock and roll magazine?
It was on purpose. It was to be bratty. It was like, in your face. In your face, Jan. Just take this.
What was rock and roll in those days? I think we're all of the same era, I think. And what were your thoughts on what rock and roll meant, especially in Michigan and in Detroit?
It was a golden era. And what Leslie was saying about Detroit and the Wayne State area, particularly Cass, it was just exploding. And we kind of, you know, those of us who grew up here, that was normal to us. We thought every town had that kind of music scene with Mitch Ryder, MC5, Iggy and the Stooges. So that's why, you know, Cream popped out of here, because there was so much to be written about on the local scene.
And actually, Lester Bangs came to Detroit because of the music scene. I mean, that was a big reason that he ended up in Detroit in the first place. In fact, we really can't talk about Cream without spending some time talking about Lester Bangs, fired by Rolling Stone for being disrespectful to musicians, and welcomed by open arms with open arms by Cream, and said, "Yeah, come on,
be disrespectful."
And people may remember that Lester Bangs was portrayed by the late Philip Seymour Hoffman in the Cameron Crowe film Almost Famous. Let's listen to a clip, and this is Lester Bangs lecturing young William Miller on the teen's hopes of becoming a rock journalist.
God, it's going to get ugly, man. They're going to buy you drinks. You're going to meet girls. They're going to try to fly you places for free, offer you drugs. And I know it sounds great, but these people are not your friends. You know, these are people who want you to write sanctimonious stories about the genius of rock stars, and they will ruin rock and roll and strangle everything we love about it. You know, because they're trying to buy respectability for a form that is gloriously and righteously dumb. I mean, I'm telling you, you're coming along at a very dangerous time for rock and roll. I mean, the war is over. They won. 99% of what passes for rock and roll these days, silence is more compelling.
I was watching your faces, and as you were watching Hoffman doing this person you knew so well, were those authentic words and authentic sentiments from Lester Bangs?
Very much like he would say. What made me react was I did interview Phil after the movie came out, and he somehow got Lester's voice somewhat, which is something only we know that who knew Lester. So I didn't like necessarily the way he looked, because he didn't bother to cover up his reddish hair, and that was a distraction to me. And he was short. Lester was a big guy,
always dark, bear-like guy
with dark hair.
Yeah.
But when the voice came out, so I said, Phil, you know, what kind of acting trick is that? How did you get his voice? Nobody would know what his voice sounds like. So what's the point of that anyway? And he said, Cameron gave me these tapes of his, lots of audio tapes of Lester talking. I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. I had never witnessed that before, that a great actor can do that. You know, weird little acting trick. So I said, kudos on the voice.
And but, that attitude that, you know, 99% of it is garbage, that was, he really was so, he was an anarchist, wasn't he?
And he kind of got the shouty way that Lester could be when he was just getting excited and talking right in the office. He could be a little shouty at times, just when he's having fun. He used to say, rock stars are not your friend. They are not our friends. At the same time, I would come into the office, and there would be Ian Hunter from Matt the Hoople sleeping on our sofa, waiting for Lester to come in. I was like, wait a minute. Ian Hunter's your friend. Ronnie Wood is your friend. They're inviting us. My first party I ever went to at Cream was at David Ruffin's house, because Ronnie Wood invited us because it was Lester. It was Lester and me and our mailboy, and he's like, come on.
And how did he reconcile that?
Exactly. It was never reconciled. That's just part of the tension. They loved him. They even liked it when he cut them down. And when Cream criticized them, most of the groups thought it was funny. They enjoyed it. Yeah, it was part of the game. But he could turn on you. He hated the MC5, famously. When he was writing for Rolling Stone, he cut them down. Rob Tyner came to be one of his best friends, and he came to love the MC5. So,
in fact, I want to have you just take a look with us at just a few of the Michigan rockers who made it into the pages of Cream and were part of that scene, and starting with the MC5. Your main impression, your main memory?
The MC5, my God. I got to see them in I think it was the Teen Center, the Palladium in Birmingham. They were just ferocious, wonderful, hilarious, and they were such a high-energy band, and they had the Detroit attitude at the Grandy Ballroom. If the Who were playing or whoever else, whatever international act, it was like, you're going to have to blow us off this stage because we're going to blow you off. And they did most of the time. They just had that little window of fame, and, you know, lots of things happened. It was the politics of the time. They were too blunt, and, you know, John Sinclair, their manager, encouraged and enabled that bluntness. And the guys now, you know, they regret that a little bit. They wish the music was more of the focus. But it is what it is. They were of their time.
I want your thoughts on, we're going to take a quick listen to Bob Seger and the Last Herd. This was before Bob Seger's System or the Silver Bullet Band. Your thoughts on Bob.
Oh, my gosh. What a great voice. The classic Michigan male rock voice, and he underestimates his voice a lot because he kind of came up with such great voices like Scott Morgan with the Rationals and Mitch Ryder. And he once told me he thought he lucked out getting with Punch Andrews, his manager, that it could have been those guys. Those guys could have hit the really big the way he did, but he was in the right place and he had the right manager who took care of him.
It's a great lesson in management, and another Birmingham story with Punch Andrews and all of that being right there in Birmingham. Grand Funk Railroad.
You know, they're underestimated. I was talking with a bunch of music writer friends on Facebook the other day and how they are just totally disrespected. But when you go back, they rocked hard. They sold out Madison Square Garden. And that was the kind of group that at Cream we would cover the heck out of them. It doesn't matter if they weren't cool. All the better.
The Stooges.
Oh, the Stooges. They were sort of the little brother band to the MC5. Iggy was a character. Who knew? I never thought he would be the icon he is now. I mean, I just didn't, because he was such a goofball, especially off stage, you know, always trying to score girls and like, oh, you think she likes me? I don't know. But on stage, he's a genius and totally self-destructive, and he's paying for it now. His one leg is shorter than the other, all that stage diving. But to see them on stage was amazing. I didn't, you know, I prefer the MC5 for the whole package, but if you want the weird rock persona, there's Iggy.
We're talking about the history of Cream magazine and looking at Michigan's rock scene in its heyday as we talk with Susan Whitehall, who's nowadays writing for the Detroit News, but she was editor at Cream, worked there from 1975 to 1983. And Leslie Pilak is with us. She took a look at Cream for the current issue of Michigan History magazine, and she is director of the Birmingham Historical Museum. Leslie, take us through the arc and then into the decline of Cream.
Well, I think in order to understand that, it's important to keep in mind that there were a lot of moving parts at Cream. There were a lot of big personalities. There were a lot of contradictory forces. And Barry Kramer, as the publisher, did what he could to try to keep that mass of energy together and moving in the direction he thought it should go. But within that planetoid system, every individual was trying to do their own thing. And I think that that was part of the beauty and the magic, and also part of what made it difficult to sustain. So as individual writers followed their own careers and left, I think it changed the dynamics tremendously at Cream. There were also forces acting on Cream that were out of their control completely, which included the recessions, they included the cost of publishing, the distribution issues, and the change in American society itself.
MTV hit in the early 80s.
Record company advertising was way down in the early 80s, and that was a disaster.
And Barry Kramer
because
died.
CDs hadn't come in yet.
Mm-hmm.
And Barry died, yeah. Within a year of Lester. It was like bang, bang.
Mm. And was that the glue that kind of dissolved after Barry died? All of these other forces.
Barry was a genius at various things. I mean, he could have done any one of our jobs. Maybe not as well as the rest of us, but he would be adequate at all of them. He was just a smart, smart guy. And I was talking with one of our early writers who's an African-American. He was early on. He was a 15-year-old writing for Cream in the Cast days. And he's in Philadelphia now. We talk a lot. And he said, you know what? Barry was a classic Detroit hustler. He knew how to put all the parts together and get it out there and sell it. You know, and he was a hippie to boot. He looked like us. He talked like us. He had the whole culture. But he could go, he used to say, I'm going to put my white belt and my white shoes on and go to the convention and talk up to the distributors and get Cream out there.
Now, I know, Leslie, there was an exhibit of Cream stuff, all kinds of great stuff, at the Birmingham Historical Museum. It's not up now, but is there any chance that the public will ever get a peek at all of that archival material that you've been able to get?
Well, not only are we investigating it as a traveling exhibit, but we actually have been accumulating an archives of Cream material that we want to make more available to the public. And we have some ideas about how we could do that online. We have some ideas we're exploring about doing some more things in person. But I think the main point to be made is that Cream and the interest in Cream is actually growing. It's an interesting phenomenon. And when we had people coming into the exhibit to see our mock office of Cream, and we had a cutout of Lester Bangs, and we had some other memorabilia, I can't tell you how surprising it was to see young people so drawn to that material. Teenagers reading Cream magazine and becoming so absorbed, you would think you were back in the 70s.
Well,
but you know, a lot of that was, Leslie did a great job. I came in, and Charlie Oringer, our founding art director, he donated a lot of his pictures, all of his stuff. They had the idea to do this, and it was great. Charlie and I helped. They actually had a workstation. They had like a desk, a Cream editor's desk that they reconstructed. So I can tell you, we went in, a bunch of my Cream editors, my buddies, and it was like we were scared. It was like being transported back. It was the old wooden desk, the old Selectric. We had the stand-up of Lester was there. And it really gave, I think, kids an idea that here are these crazy young people, much like themselves, in this little tiny office in Birmingham, and look what they did. It didn't stop them that they were in a suburb. It didn't stop them that they were in Detroit. We were number two to Rolling Stone, even though there was a big gap of circulation. So you just do what you do. And
Detroit scrappiness. Well, you have to let us know if this gets out, and we can let the public know how they can get to see it. But in the interim, you can read Leslie Pylak's look at Cream in the current issue of Michigan History Magazine. We could probably talk for the next day about all these great, great memories. It's been really a pleasure. Leslie, thank you so much for being with us. And Susan Whitehall, the editor of Cream and nowadays writing for the Detroit News and has been since 1983. Thank you so much to both of you for taking us through this very special time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.